Hi, and welcome to Jump Scare, the podcast that sees it coming. I'm Shanice.
And I'm Will.
And we're both alive.
For now. As of recording, we are alive.
It is a very weird time to be a human being, not only in America, but on Earth right now.
Yeah, it really is. We are deep in the coronavirus cocoon. So we decided to switch things up this week.
We sure did.
Yeah. So we were all set to do our Blumhouse arc, and we're still going to be doing that. But we decided that we should switch gears, and we are bringing you a viral arc, and we are starting off with Contagion.
We're giving the people what they want. Everyone really right now is home. You're worried. You're hoarding Purell. There's a whole lot of shit going on. So the reason that we picked this is not only because it's a great movie, but in early January, there were all these articles out about Contagion. And the reason for it is not only because people were interested in such a realistic depiction of how diseases would spread, but Contagion wasn't streaming. So you had to buy it. And like, you only could buy it on iTunes. And everyone was like, what the fuck? Because we're so used to like, this is a normal commodity of like, what do you mean I can't stream it or buy it on Google or like do this and this on Amazon? And it was like, no, this is available on one spot. And that's all you've got going for you. But then it became one of the most torrented movies of January and February.
I believe it. And I just looked as of today. It is the number 3 movie on iTunes. For downloads.
I believe that. I had to like get a free trial of Cinemax, aka Skinemax, on Hulu.
Not anymore, because, man.
Well, I don't know. I don't pay for it. But it was the only way I could watch it. Yeah.
Yeah. Get Cinemax, folks.
So Contagion. Tell us the director, set the year. What's going on right now, Will?
Yeah, yeah. So this is a 2011 film. It is by Steven Soderbergh. It is written by Scott Z. Burns. It has a score by Cliff Martinez. We're going to talk about all of those things. The one thing I would say before we get any deeper in is that this is a movie that is like style-wise, budget-wise, prestige-wise, just in a different category than anything we've looked at before.
Truly.
We're stepping a kind of away from pure horror. We're moving into like big Hollywood sort of blockbuster territory.
Well, it's also like we usually, for some reason and not purposefully, we've done all these films that are like the breakout first directorial like debuts of all these people. And now we've got like a pro and he's like, this is nothing. Like this is the same old shit. But what's interesting is that this is truly one of his horror. And like it's not a genre that it's not really his playground. And it's weird because technically this is a horror movie, but because of all the elements of this, it doesn't feel like a horror. And again, it's because he's always exploring systems. It feels just, I don't know, it's hard to explain, but I know it's a horror movie and it doesn't feel like one traditionally.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I don't think he would describe it as a horror movie, but I think it functions in the way that a horror movie does. I usually see it described as like a thriller, a medical thriller.
Medical thriller. That's because no one takes horror seriously, Will.
That is true. I mean, yeah, it is kind of horror. It
has all the beats and it follows. Yeah. It has some of the elements of a horror movie, the way that it plays with music and like the way that the stories are told and like the way that a lot of shots are framed are horror. I don't know. It's a hard cookie to crack. But the score in this movie is phenomenal. It like is the perfect balance between sci-fi and also, I don't know, but like it feels so futuristic without intending to, if that makes any sense. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's really anxiety inducing.
Anxiety. There you go. It's like the waiting room of a doctor's office, but on Mars.
Right. It's by Cliff Martinez, he's done Neon Demon. He did Drive. He did Spring Breakers with Skrillex. He did Traffic. He's done a bunch of Soderbergh films. Yeah, the music is a big part of this film. It keeps the thing moving and it drives a lot of scenes. There's a lot of scenes in this movie that don't have dialogue, which is kind of an example of something that horror movies do, right?
Right.
One way that it's a horror film is that it's not really about people. It's not really about characters. I mean, there are some characters in it and the performances are, I think, really good, but the people are kind of just set pieces to tell the story, which is a very horror thing. So in the scenes with no dialogue, the music is really doing a lot of the work in terms of setting the mood while the visuals tell the story. It's really a remarkably efficient storytelling, I think.
It really is.
Can do this.
It's also, to sort of like jump around here, I really want to get back to the fact that it is a horror. Not only is it the music, but it's the writing, because once again, we are being punished for having sex.
Oh, that's interesting.
She cheats on her husband.
Yeah. And that's how
she
infects all of Chicago.
Yep. So like again, a small element of like the way that horror plays with sexual relationships and stuff like that. This movie has it. But it's also, you're right, there's not a lot of dialogue, but I would argue that like this is such a well-written film, which is like a weird thing to think about, because I think you're right, the humans are like set pieces, but when they do speak, you're just like either heartbroken or I don't know, it like really sets you, makes you feel like you're there. Like I think that everyone who's reacting in this film is reacting the way that a human would. Like it doesn't feel fake, and I think it's something that we find in horror a lot, that it's kind of like, you fucking idiot, like why would you do that? This feels very much like, if I had to face this choice, this is what I would do for sure. Like, this is how I would handle XYZ.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one of the reasons it's been so popular, is that it has this reputation as one of the more accurate depictions of kind of all the pieces that get set in motion in the case of a pandemic. I was talking with my partner who I watched this with, and she said that she kept expecting there to be like a rip in one of the containment suits that the scientists are wearing as they sort of work on the virus to try and find a vaccine. And I think a lesser film would have that, and maybe like a horror film would have that, right? Like, you know, they
right.
would, it, the audience would know about the rip, and then that dramatic irony would kind of be worked on to create this tension. But this is such a sterile film almost that it rejects that sort of melodrama. In fact, we actually get a scene where we see them early on blowing up their suits before they put them on and then checking for any holes or rips, which is just a sort of like procedural detail that I think distinguishes this movie from, you know, Outbreak or another movie in the genre, in that it is rational. It isn't moralizing or goofy the way a lot of horror movies can be.
Right. It's so set in reality. And that, in my opinion, is what makes it so scary, is that nothing that happens in this movie seems outlandish to me.
Mm-hmm.
God, yeah. And that's terrifying. They're like filling up the suits and I was just like, what's going to happen here? Like all of the normal scares that you think you'd get, you don't. But you get like the actual, like I was telling Will before we started recording, my throat, you know, closes up when I watch this movie. Suddenly I have a bit of a cough, which I really don't want right now, clearly.
Right. Yeah.
But it's such a like visceral reaction, because you're like, this feels so real and logical and rational, and it's so set in reality.
Totally. I think this question of is it horror or not is still an interesting one. I agree with you. I think it is a horror. I don't think it's just a horror film, but I think it is horror. And I think maybe you could compare it to films like 28 Days Later or Let the Right One In, movies that increasingly are trying to bring this sort of realistic lens to the horror genre. You know, it's not Evil Dead, it's not like a ridiculous slasher movie, but I think there is this movement in like the 2000s, 2010s towards what would a horror movie be like if it was like really realistic? Like, what would a horror movie actually look like in the real world? I mean, like Cloverfield, right? Or like a lot of our found footage movies dealt with like, what would a horror movie plot actually look like in the real world, where like the police actually come and people have cell phones and that sort of thing.
Right.
So I think you could say that this is sort of at least tangentially part of that consideration. I don't know if you'd call it a genre, but like that, you know, consideration of the hyper-realistic horror movie.
Yeah. No, I think that makes a lot of sense. So getting into their marketing and the taglines. So the marketing for this was also very hyper-realistic. So according to IMDb and then a couple blogs that I found, to promote this film, Warner Brothers Pictures Canada built two giant petri dishes and they treated it with bacteria and fungi and they set them up in a storefront like window. And then over several days, because of the way bacteria and fungi, you know, works, it grew out to spell the name of the movie and form.
Holy shit.
Yeah. And form biohazard symbols. Like, that's fucking bonkers. One, that would never fly in even like 2017, I think. And two is like genius marketing, because you've got people coming back and trying to figure out what the fuck this is. I think in general, like the general public, there's something about petri dishes scares us because we think of labs. We think of being at the doctor. We think of, you know, Resident Evil and like zombies and stuff. So every piece of that was genius to me.
Yeah, I think that's brilliant.
So it's interesting to me that they did this because Saw, a couple years later, maybe a couple years before this, sent out vials of blood of Jigsaw, of the killer. Another thing that would not fly now, but I feel like the early aughts, insane sort of marketing campaigns like these were totally normal.
Yeah, because it was the birth of viral marketing, right?
Mm-hmm.
People were just doing whatever they wanted, and some people were really pushing the limits of what you could do. Was it actual blood?
What it was you got a vial that had fake blood in it. But you got this poster, and the poster was printed with the blood of the actor who played Jigsaw. And it was like, it wasn't that much blood. I think it was like two or three drops, and they mixed it in with the ink. And they were like, fuck it, have these posters. But still, you wouldn't see that shit today. That's terrifying.
Yeah, that's wild. Yeah, and so the taglines for this movie, they had a bunch of them, right?
Yeah, they've got three. And, like, the first one is super cheesy and, like, obviously, like, a general, like, this is the punniest thing that we can do. And it's the world goes viral September 9th.
Uh-huh.
The other two are basically, like, what we're hearing on the news right now.
Yeah,
and,
right.
Like, on the internet. And it's don't talk to anyone, don't touch anyone, and nothing spreads like fear. Yeah, which is, like, surreal to think about.
It really is. It's just wild that this moment actually is happening. We're going to talk more about that, but that's crazy.
It is crazy. What was the budget?
So it cost $60 million to make, which is like we're used to watching movies that cost a few hundred thousand, you know, maybe a few million, but this one cost $60 million. You could make roughly 120 Evil Deads for that number.
That's the bar for us.
Right. That's the measurement. They did shooting on location in Hong Kong, in Chicago, in Atlanta, in San Francisco, a bunch of other places. Most of it was shot in Chicago and Hong Kong. Yeah, and the cast is huge and so many big names. Jude Law, Gwyneth Paltrow, Lawrence Fishburne, Matt Damon, et cetera, et cetera. Jennifer L., 2-time Tony Award winning Jennifer L. It looks expensive. You know, Soderbergh's yes. films always look very expensive. They're very polished. You know, the editing is great. The sort of the finish on the film is great. The visuals are very composed and refined. And it looks like it costs $60 million to its credit, I think.
It does. And you would expect that, again, because we on this show, we often talk about, like, the punk rockness of, like, horror. And it's not to say that this isn't punk rock, but, like, this is what comes with the name. Like, the cast of this is insane, and I have no doubt that they cost a ton of money to, like, yeah. contract. This is also, you've got Breaking Bad, Walter White. What's his real name? Bryan Cranston,
yeah.
Interesting that, so none of the marketing apparently mentioned him. And this is at the height of his Breaking Bad fame. But it's the sort of thing where you have to think that a lot of these actors probably were just excited to work with Steven. Like, the fact that, like, they were even asked to do something like... Like, it's just really interesting to see how, you know, your budget changes when you're a famous award-winning director.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally. I mean, it's a bit like a Tarantino effect.
Exactly.
Where just everyone wants to walk with them. Yeah. I mean, Steven Soderbergh, we didn't mention it when we talked about the directors. This is a guy who made Traffic, Aaron Brockovich, Out of Sight, and Ocean's 11 within like 3 years, a 3 year span. He made three of those movies within 18 months of each other. His success is almost like, I mean, he's done a lot of experimental movies too, like The Girlfriend Experience, Bubble, that haven't done as well, but it would be difficult to overstate how like successful both critically and commercially he's been. There, like, really only someone like a Christopher Nolan, you know,
right,
is someone I could think of to compare to, who's sort of on his level of like both being incredibly respected and also just destroying at the box office consistently.
It's funny that you mentioned The Girlfriend Experience, because I think that this movie and The Girlfriend Experience shows how ahead of his time he is. Because, like, yeah, it wasn't that big of a splash then. The Girlfriend Experience now feels more real because we are living in virtual sort of worlds. Like, it's just Contagion didn't, not that it didn't do so well. I think that a lot of people had trouble taking it seriously, again, because it's a thriller and like a medical piece, but not necessarily body horror. But no one took it seriously because we had films like The Happening. We had all of these like science-based, quote-unquote, movies that no one really paid attention to. But if that were to come out now, I think that more people would be paying attention.
Well, yeah. Definitely.
I mean, yeah. Aside from coronavirusness,
right? Yeah, we let's actually skip to context a little bit.
Wait, before we do, Will, how much money did it make back?
Oh, right. So it cost $60 million, and it made $135.5 million, roughly like 60-40 domestic, international, 75 domestic, $60 million international. Opened at number one, stayed at number one for a week. Then it was like number two the next week and, you know, continued to perform at the box office for months and months.
Then maybe I'm wrong. I'm completely wrong. It did really well then.
Yeah. Oh, Contagion. Yeah, Contagion did really well. It is not a movie that like won any awards or dominated, I think, the discussion the way Aaron Brockovich or Traffic or The Oceans,
right,
series did. But yeah, it did very, very well. It was made kind of in the wake of the H1N1 scare, which I think was a bigger scare than I realized. I tend to kind of disregard all this stuff.
Right.
Like, I'm just not someone who really pays attention to international diseases. You know, bird flu, H1N1, SARS, any of those. But H1N1 was apparently a very big deal, and it inspired...
Was apparently. Yeah, it was.
That inspired the film directly, and I think may have driven sort of the success of this movie. But like all these things, you know, it made a stir, and then it kind of goes back into hiding and people forget about it. So,
right.
Yeah.
So yeah, we're gonna be a little different, and we're gonna jump to the historical context because it's so fucking real.
Yeah.
Right now. So people were scrambling, like we said, to watch this movie again right now because, I don't know, you may be living under a rock, but there's this thing called COVID-19, which, like the virus in the film, is a novel virus, which basically means no one has any sort of immunity to it because it's just newly introduced to society and to human bodies, which is a terrifying thing because, like the movie shows you and like we are living right now, it's easy to spread and we can't count on our, you know, vaccines or immunizations to necessarily get us through. And it's just kind of terrifying. It's terrifying. And one of the reasons I think that so many people sought this film out, from what I've been reading, is that they consulted with a lot of former CDC employees and like scientists to make sure that the virus and the way that it spread in the film was as realistic as possible.
You can see that in like the bureaucratic hell of so much of the response. And that is something that I find really terrifying when I think about it, when I'm like confronted with it. That may be one of the reasons I try to avoid paying attention to outbreaks when they happen. Just the like, well, we need to grow it in a lab. And then once we learn how to do that, then we can start experimenting with the vaccine. And then once we do that, then we can test it on humans. And then once we do that, we can work on how to manufacture it. Once we do that, we can get a distribution plan together. Like the fact that there's so many steps and there's so each one is so complicated and like the authority for it is so diffuse. You know, the WHO, the CDC, every country, every state. Obviously, we're seeing this now with the slow response to provide testing in the U.S. and elsewhere.
Yep.
That's really scary because it's not... it's like American life is so complicated.
Yes.
and like there's no easy solution. You can streamline things a little bit if you're lucky. Generally, it goes the other way. But you just like... There's so many steps between crisis and everything being okay again. And that is one of this movie's strengths, that it really gets into the nuts and bolts of that, which is, on the one hand, could be boring cinema. In this case, I think it's actually really compelling. But to me, that's one of the real horrors of this movie, in my opinion.
Yes. This movie like brings up a lot of fears for me right now. I am a immunocompromised person. I have lupus, which means that, you know, I've got my immune system thinks that I'm kind of always sick, in layman's terms, and attacks itself. I am attacking my own body. So the idea of having a virus around me and getting sick is really scary. And I will say that one of the in terms of like the bureaucracy behind this was when they were figuring out the vaccine. And they're like, fuck it, we're going to do it by birthdays. And I was like, that's insane. And like giving it to the government employees first and just it like, again, it's a horror of the systems that we have in place and how much we're lacking. And I think that that's why so many people right now are turning to a movie like this, is because more than ever, it's sort of like, you know, during a election year. Everyone suddenly thinks that they know everything about politics and how their local election works and all of this stuff. And it's like, you don't. You just got into it. And that's how everyone is sort of reacting right now, that they're all like researching. They're like, this is how the WHO, you know, the World Health Organization works and the CDC. And look how, you know, Korea's doing it. Look how Canada's doing it. And it's just a sort of, it's like top of mind, I guess.
Yeah.
But yeah, I agree. That's one of the horrors, is just kind of like we think we have a system in place and we don't. We simply do not. And this film shows the breakdown of that. And we're, you know, not to sound alarmist, but we're sort of living through that currently in America with the lack of testing and the lack of support. The fact that a city has to claim itself in a state of emergency in order to get funding is fucking ridiculous to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're getting heavy and real on jump scare.
Yeah. So people are getting angrier and angrier as they come up against this tremendously complicated machine that is sort of modern bureaucracy and modern government.
Right.
And, you know, it's such a mix of like there's a lot of bureaucracy and a lot of waste because people are, you know, trying to kind of get rich or like,
mm-hmm.
make careers for themselves and like think more selfishly than selflessly, but also just because life these days is so complicated.
Right.
And like the CDC budget for a lot of the response to this stuff was cut, and that's ridiculous, but also there's like 8 million other things that seemed just as pressing at the time, so no one was thinking about this.
Right.
What I think of is that scene with Katie Porter, the congresswoman who got the CDC head to, like, quote unquote, commit to free testing.
Mm-hmm.
And I have no idea how that's going to turn out, but I saw a lot of people on Twitter, like, really cheering it, and it was a great moment. And it was exactly the sort of, I think, leadership a lot of us want from our government. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, in my head, I'm thinking, like, didn't the government outsource a lot of the testing to private companies who are then interacting with private insurance companies to, you know, pay for the test? And like, does CDC, does the government at all have any authority over that? Does the CDC in this case have authority? Does this person have authority at the CDC? Is anything going to come out of this? You know, it's this stuff is so complicated. It's not just one person saying yes, okay, at one, you know, at one congressional hearing. It's like it may take months to get those tests covered, or you have to pay for it up front, and then down the road the CDC will work with Congress to pass a bill that will work with private insurers to set up a system for getting rebated that you then have to apply for, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
I think Obama comparing the government to an oil tanker that turns very, very, very slowly. It does turn, but tremendously slowly, I think is apt. And that's a really scary image compared to like the outbreak of a virus.
Right.
you know, which we see in this movie.
Oh, God, do we?
Yeah.
And I think the other thing about like this movie now and it becoming so popular speaks volumes about how much we need a distraction, if that makes any sense. And I think speaks volumes about the fact that so for millennials and sort of like Gen Z, the distraction is us sort of scaring ourselves in a way. I don't know. I think there's something really interesting there about like us living through this and this becoming the number three movie because people are just kind of like, this is where they're finding their solace in a way,
yeah.
Like inside of art, but art that is mimicking real life.
That isn't soothing at all.
Exactly. That's what I mean. Like for me, we've talked about it, like horror soothes me and I'm super into this. But that's not normally the case for a lot of people of like, oh, I'm terrified. Let me make myself more scared, especially on like such a real level. Like we, you know, legitimately the tagline, don't talk to anyone. Don't fucking cough. Social distance yourself 6 feet away from me.
Right.
Is really, I don't know. I don't know what it says about us in society, but I think it says good things in a way. Appreciate art.
I think so. I think it speaks to concepts like pleasure and comfort being a lot more complicated than they're often represented as. And that's true across all of horror. And this podcast basically exists because of the complications of those concepts, right? This is a great example that like you're not going to necessarily learn anything from Contagion except, you know, the absolute worst case scenario and how realistic it is.
Also, you learn how much people touch their fucking faces.
Yeah.
People touch their faces all the time. I'm not a face toucher.
Mm-hmm.
Before anyone comes at me and they're like, but you have all these pictures. The only time I touch my face is when I'm posing for a picture to be cute. But in general, I've never been a face toucher. And part of that is because I have really sensitive skin. And also I wear makeup. So I try not to touch my face.
Mm.
But people touch their face so often. And this movie shows you that like you're doing it when you don't even fucking realize. And it's gross. Please stop touching your face.
It's so hard though.
It is so hard. And I get it. It's sort of like it's the automatic of like when you're stressed or how else do you touch your face? All I can think about is stress.
Yeah. Yeah. I was on the subway in Brooklyn the other day and I was for the first time totally aware of how often I touch my face because I was doing it. Just like Kate Winslet says in the movie, like 2 to 3 times a minute.
Yep.
Because I do touch my face all the time. I itch my...
He just touched his face, y'all.
Yeah. And I don't know if I could stop. Like, I can cut it down, but I don't know if I can stop.
It's not easy to stop, I guess. That's true.
Yeah. Yeah. The camera work in this movie is so masterful and so unsettling in that it just calls attention to all the face touching and all the lingering on objects that people touch, the doorway, the doorknobs, the cell phones, the wall of a bus stop, all of these things.
Mm-hmm.
It just does such a good job of calling attention to that. The difficulty of really keeping yourself safe, almost the impossibility of it.
Right. And I think that it's interesting to see in a film because it's the sort of thing where when you're watching a movie, I think your brain automatically wants to see humans and faces. And it's very purposeful that in all of these scenes, when we are seeing a cell phone or someone grab a pole, the faces are cut out. And to the point where when she's in the restaurant and I think she's handing over one of the chips, it's so zoomed in that you don't even see the people in the background. Your focus is on this action in this moment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's beautiful because it's so scary. But again, because it's so rooted in reality, you grab stuff from strangers all the time. You grab a pole and you don't think much of it. So to see it zoomed in and you're like, what is the life of this inanimate object before I came in contact with it is like terrifying. And then again, there's that, you know, sort of medical sci-fi music that plays every time we see a connection in terms of like an object that was touched that definitely has the virus.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so good.
It really is a good movie. Yeah, the sort of humming, living... The soundtrack is almost like an organism. It's like the microbiome on everything that's sort of like humming and buzzing and beeping all the time.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I didn't even think of it like that, but that's totally...
Yeah.
So some WTF moments aside from the entire movie.
Yeah, right. Get back on our normal structure here.
Our best scare, which I took some liberty with, and we generally are allowed to take liberty with because, you know, what's scary is scary. Will, what's your best scare?
My best scare is the scene where Gwyneth Paltrow's business partner, who picked her up at the airport or like drove her to the airport, gets a call and he's clearly sick and Kate Winslet tells him to just get off the bus right away. And he's like, he's trying to get off the bus, but he has to like brush past like a dozen people. And then he gets off and he's immediately like thrust into another crowd of people. And he's trying to get out of this bus like enclosure and he's really sick. And he's like leaning against the bus enclosure and he's infecting everything. That sense of like claustrophobia really unsettled me. Shanice and I both have the good fortune of living and working in a low density place like New York City. So this isn't something we experience every single day.
God.
I remember this when I moved to the city from the Connecticut suburb that I was living in before, of just the crush of people all the time.
Yeah.
And just imagining like if you were sick, there's just no escape from people.
Yep.
They're everywhere for like miles, like 20 miles in every direction. Like it's going to take you all day to get away from a person.
Well, it's also the sort of thing where, you know, living in New York, you can't always just walk to the doctor's office. You can't just walk to the ER. You may have to get on a bus. You may have to get on a subway. Again, it's really weird to think about the status and the health of the people around you. But yeah, I can see why that's scary. It's also, I think that what makes that scene so good for me is that so far all of the like face shots that we've gotten are, you know, Gwyneth dead when they're, you know, buzzing off her head. Poor Gwyneth Paltrow. She can't ever keep her head.
That's true.
The other girl in the beginning, they show the scene of the girl with her eyes wide open after having a seizure. We haven't had a face close up until that point of someone infected but living. And that's our first one. And it's him. And he's so perfectly aligned in the center, red and like slightly pale. But he's shaking and it pulls out. And you're like, he's outside. So like, again, it's this sort of thing of like, I don't know, like what's happening? Is he shaking because he's cold? Is he shaking because he's, you know, going to die? Oh, it is a really good scene.
Yeah.
For me, like my best scare isn't necessarily a scare. It's probably the most chilling moment for me. I was my partner didn't watch this movie with me because he was busy, not because he didn't want to. I'm making him watch it. But I was telling him about this moment and it gives me chills, like it gives me goosebumps. And it's when Matt Damon finds out that his wife is dead.
Yeah.
And what's so scary for me and like chilling in that moment is that the doctor's like, in such a, the tone of the actor is so good because he's like, yeah, and unfortunately she died.
Right.
and says it like it's like, oh, you know, whoops, that's like a complication, a consequence, whatever. And Matt Damon like doesn't register that. He just registers the tone, which I think speaks to like when we're scared, we like can see someone talking in front of us and we're like, I don't know what's going on.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he's like, okay, can I go talk to her? And he's like, no, she's dead. And he's like, what do you mean she's dead? Like, I just spoke to her. We just had dinner. We just did XYZ.
Yeah.
And like, that's so scary to me because that speaks to like how quick this disease works.
Yeah.
And also is such a good example of fear. And like the way that fear spreads is that our brain, when we're in a panic sometimes, doesn't want to register what's going on. It just wants things to go back to normal, which is clearly where he's at in that moment.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. He just can't accept that there would be a change. Yeah. I really also really love the doctor's delivery because it's just, it's impossible news to really deliver. It's like the healthy person you knew who was like 35 and, you know, Gwyneth Paltrow looking is just dead and they don't know why. And that also, I think, is one of the best moments of the film. And Matt Damon just does such a good job where he just, there's so much in that moment that mm-hmm. we're experiencing now on, like, fortunately, a less, well, in general, a less tragic level of just like all of a sudden, all the sports leagues are canceled. And Tom Hanks has coronavirus.
Not Tom and Hanks.
Everyone's working. I know. And everyone's working from home. And it's just, it's starting to feel more normal now that mm-hmm. we're a few weeks into it. But it's still, it's just hard to find a mental space where the fact that we're in the middle of a pandemic that is shutting down basically the entire country is true.
Right.
It's just hard to comprehend.
It is. It's hard to wrap your head around it. I will say it's a little fucked up to me, like the more I think about it, that death affects me more than the kid dying because the kid like dies in his bed and I'm just like, fuck it, I don't care. Like, move on. I need to know what this virus is. Oh, it is chilling.
Yeah. The kid's death is almost a little weird because it just, I don't know, we don't see any of the fallout from it, really.
No, we don't. And also, like, the kid kind of felt like an afterthought in general.
Mm-hmm.
I honestly think that, like, the character of the kid is just to show you, like, how much shit Matt Damon's going through. And again, this, we talked about this, like, the personal relationships in this film are very bizarre. And, like, things that are meant to make you feel something in terms of like, oh, I relate to that, don't really do that. And I think the kid's death is one of those moments where I'm just kind of like, oh no, I already had the moment where I felt bad, but I didn't even like, again, the whole Matt Damon and Gwyneth Paltrow, like that death scene wasn't about this dude's wife dying for me. It was about his fear. Yeah, it's a little weird.
Yeah, I agree. And the later scenes where the daughter shows up, to me, Red is very strange. The like,
yes,
he doesn't tell her that her brother is dead.
Stepbrother.
Okay, so that wasn't her mom.
No.
Okay, I thought I'd picked up on that, but still, it just seems like they never deal with that.
Well, she does.
But maybe
he's
in shock because like his wife and son are dead.
No. When she gets to the hospital to talk to him through the glass, she's like, and Clark, I think the name of the kid is Clark. And he goes, this thing just moves so quickly. He does tell her. She doesn't register it. So I think that, again, what this is supposed to like suggest is that she didn't really like Gwyneth Paltrow. Like, I also don't know where the kid was living because he's like, go to your mom. I don't know. It's really, again, it's really fucking weird. Like, where the fuck was she in that morning? I don't know.
Right. It's one of the few beats in this movie that doesn't really come together. But again, like you said, it's not really a movie about their relationship or his family or, you know, who these people are. They're kind of stand-ins for just the total shock and like breakdown of normal life. Yeah. So what would you say is your most iconic moment from this film?
So my most iconic moment is the ending because we spend Marianne's storyline, she's the doctor who is kidnapped. A lot of her storyline is trying to figure out, okay, who is patient zero or who's mm-hmm. The index patient. The way that we see the like passage of time is day 21 of the outbreak, day 144, all of this stuff. And we, you know, we never really, throughout the whole thing, we don't really know where it's come from. Mm-hmm. We have a feeling, and because the film tells us that Gwyneth Paltrow is the index patient, but we're never really sure. Like, we're, you know, no one wants to admit that it came from their country or something. And in the end, you know, Matt Damon has this weird breakdown in his daughter's bizarre living room prom.
yeah.
And we see nature. And at first, you think that this is going to be a moment where, like, look, life is getting back to normal. It leads you down that road because you're like, there are trees and bats and everything's happening. And then it goes on.
And then you think, oh, wait, bat. Where have I heard bat before in this movie?
Exactly. And we see how the disease came to be. And it ends on a shot with essentially that it was a bat that has droppings into a pigsty, essentially. One of the pigs eats it. Mm-hmm. That pig is then picked by the chef that, you know, talks to Gwyneth Paltrow. Uh-huh. He doesn't wash his hands and he goes out to greet her. And then slowly it fades on, because every other time in the film when we see the day, it's immediate. It's red. It's right there in this beautiful font. And here it fades on and it says day one. And you're like, yes. Fuck. It's such an interesting note to end this film on, because you want it to end on a happy note. You want there to be hope. We've got the vaccine. You know, things are going to get better. It almost like makes you feel like, oh, this is just going to repeat itself in a weird way. I don't know. Like, it's just, it's such a beautiful, weird, surreal ending that I think is iconic.
Yeah, I agree. I have the same moment. I think the film's most masterful little detail is the fact that it opens on day two.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't even really clock it at first, but it's such a brilliant little, like, wait, day two, this is already in motion. What right. was day one? And then we get day one at the end. Yeah, I agree.
Oh, it's so good.
Yeah. Because it shows that no one really did anything wrong, right?
Yep.
I guess there's the one villain is Jude Law's character, who's kind of a weird subplot.
Mm-hmm.
Although I can tell you, looking at like some right-wing media is absolutely realistic.
Yep.
In terms of people being like, no, it's like, it's not a big deal. The virus is no big deal. Yeah, like the mutation was pretty normal. It happens in nature. And like you could blame factory farming, right? Like you mm-hmm. could blame like big systems that put this in place. But on a human level, it's really just the cook didn't wash his hands. Maybe he should have. But like how often does everybody do this on a daily basis? And then she right. just went out and had a fun night. And, you know, or even her like affair wasn't really condemned by the film.
Right.
I think it's really interesting when you point out that that's such a horror trope, because I think it may have been a reference to that, but
yeah.
Sort of in the sort of rational, cold tone of this film. It's just, you know, something that humans do. It's like it's a predictive algorithm.
It's a fact
of
life.
Behavior. Yeah.
Which is why I think, again, like this movie is so weird to me, because it's so, it feels very matter of fact. Like, that happened. Okay, we're moving on to the next thing. And, like, even Kate Winslet's character, you know, when Lawrence Fishburne, like, asked her, like, oh, like, are you okay, whatever? She's like, have you ever had to tell a man whose wife just died that she was cheating on him? And he was like, no, but I'm sure you did the best you could. Like, I haven't, but in the scheme of things, not really what matters right now.
Right. Right.
Like, sucks to suck, Matt. You know, you got other shit to deal with.
Right. What is the body count of this film?
So impossibly high.
It really
is. Terrifying.
At what point we get a number of at least 2.5 million? I don't know if that's in the U.S. or worldwide. I don't remember.
They purposefully don't tell us.
Yeah.
That's so many fucking people.
So many people. It seems to be a roughly a 20% death rate, which is incredibly high. It's worth noting that I think coronavirus right now is like 2 to 3%.
Yeah.
So like as much as we're alarmed by this podcast, we should also specify with most likely 2.5 million people are not going to die from this.
Yeah, exactly.
This is not, you know, the breakdown of law and order and everything is going to fall apart. The body count, it's like a $60 million movie with a 2.5 million person body count. It's just a different kind of film.
It's also like no one is safe because you've got the Kate Winslet character who seems like she's going to get shit done. Like she's got a plan. She knows what she needs to do and she gets sick. And like even throughout being sick, she like calls and she's like, she calls the front desk. She's like, who serviced my room? Who brought me my, you know, room service, all of this stuff. Mm-hmm. And again, her death is treated in such a cold manner because we see her to her last dying breath trying to help someone else. She's trying to give the guy next to her her coat because he's cold.
Yeah.
And she doesn't have the strength. And then the next shot we see is her in a body bag, in a fucking, you know, like large plot of the
mass grave.
A mass grave. There you go. And like, it's just, it's fucking insane. And like goes to show you like in this movie and in general, like diseases don't care how much shit you have to get done or like what your role in society is. Like if you get sick and you don't treat it, you die. Like, sorry.
Yeah. And it calls attention to like impossible moral choices. Like, yeah, all the government members get the vaccine first, and maybe that's totally unfair because chances are they're in government because of all sort of entrenched system, like unequal systems of power and wealth and all that. But at the same time, if you don't give the people in charge the vaccine, then they're going to get it, and then the people in charge are going to die, and nothing is going to get done.
Right.
So you have this like really sort of awful calculus that I think this film calls attention to over and over, where like you almost have to disregard conventional morality in the name of like helping people down the road and getting to a point where everyone will eventually have the vaccine or, you know, be cured or whatever it is.
Right.
Yeah. It's like a very inhuman accounting of how biology works, how people work as like systems of cells, and like it's just interesting. It's like the horror of reality.
Yes.
Which is neither, you know, moral nor immoral.
In the show notes I wrote, the world is dead and so is God.
And so is God, right. Right. This is a godless world.
Basically.
Yeah.
So we've talked about like what didn't work and we can now sort of get a little more into it. What do you think didn't work aside from, you know, the relationships of the folks?
I think that was the biggest failing such that it was in this movie. A lot of the Matt Damon stuff was great. But then, like, the relationship with the daughter was a little unclear. And I thought, like, the robbery scenes, like, the time that Matt Damon sees, like, his neighbors get shot to death, it seems like. I don't know. That seemed like a bit of a superfluous scene. Like, that's where melodrama creeped in a little bit.
Right.
But, yeah, I would say that's the biggest one. And then the Alan Crumweedy, I think is how you say his name. The Jude Law character, the conspiracy theorist. That was just a little hard to understand. I thought a little at times disconnected from the rest of the plot.
It really did. And I think that like he was supposed to represent, obviously, the internet. And like I get it. Mm-hmm. And how these things spread. It just felt like, it almost felt like a parody of an internet villain.
Yeah.
I think that that character maybe would have been a little more successful if he were, to pull from real life, an ex-government employee or something like that, then uses the internet to spread something. But no, it's just sort of like a dude who, you know, wants to report the truth. And then, you know, we find out at the end that, like, he's a baddie and he was never even fucking sick. And, like, he's just made a bunch of money off of Forsythia. to show you, you know, like, everyone's out to get themselves. This is how, you know, fear spreads, and we'll look to any person to guide us and lead us. But yeah, it didn't, I don't think it really helped, not necessarily helped, but his storyline just felt so separated, I agree, from both, you know, the CDC and, like, how the disease was spreading and Matt Damon. Like, I just didn't feel, it took too long for us to connect those dots to him, right, to the main story, for me to feel like he added anything.
Yeah, I agree. I think there was a story there. I think his character was interesting. And ultimately, his kind of inscrutable motives, like, he was obviously greedy, and maybe that was his sole motive, but also he seemed to have some, like, genuine sort of anti-governmental ideas. And obviously when he's, like, wandering around the cities in his little, like, homemade biohazard suit, like, he's looking for something there.
Right.
So I thought he was, there was a story there. To me, it reminded me of, like, a Julian Assange or something.
Yeah.
Someone who's, like, a mix of, like, almost certainly a bad actor and out to profit,
mm-hmm,
but also sort of a rogue player whose motivations are unclear. And obviously, with the rise of the Trump whole world, we've met so many of these characters,
yeah,
who are just, like, such a mix of, like, anti-establishment and also brutally capitalist. But maybe, like, he belonged in a different movie.
Yeah. Like, what was up with the whole, like, girlfriend being pregnant?
Yeah, I didn't understand who that person was at all. I still don't totally understand.
Right? That felt like out of nowhere. I was just like, did he have a...
I thought that was his, like, editor, but then it was... I don't know. It was, none of it really made sense to me.
Yeah. Suddenly, like, out of left field, I was like, what the fuck is happening?
Yeah. Run up the stairs instead of out of the house award for the dumbest decision. Shanice, who would you award this to?
It's hard in a movie like this because there is no real way to run out of the house, I think, in a situation that we're presented in this film. Mm-hmm. I think that, like, the dumbest thing, and again, you can't avoid it, is when Angela, Lawrence Fishburne's fiance, essentially, they're not married, tells her friend what's going on.
Yeah.
And that was really fucking dumb and really stupid because, of course, it was going to get out. The woman puts it on Facebook. However, I can't fully fault her for that because if I had that sort of information and my best friend called me, my best friend who, like, you know, we are shown to have children.
Right.
I would want to tell her and be like, you get out. Like, this is it. This is really serious. You know, the survival rate isn't very high. But honestly, like, it kind of also sounds like she told her too much because, like, she reports on, like, the R not. And I was like, why would you tell this woman, you know, all of this really important? Just tell her to get the fuck out. You don't have to, like, go into it.
Right.
So I think that's the dumbest. What about you?
Yeah, I agree. That's probably the dumbest. I also agree that really it's just the film does such a good job of showing how interconnected we are. And, like, unless you are going to become a prepper and, like, have, like, a go plan to get out of Dodge as soon as something like this happens, you know, there's really no way to get out of the house. It's hard to justify preparing for every single disaster, too. Like, we can't sort of live at that intensity. It would be intolerable. So there's nothing you could do.
I agree.
Even, like, Gwyneth Paltrow, like, touching everything in the casino, she's not doing anything wrong. She's not doing anything that any of us wouldn't do on any given night out with our friends.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't really know what the solution is.
There just isn't one.
Yeah.
Wash your hands and don't touch your fucking face.
Right, don't touch your face, right. And fund government. This is an argument for government, this film. Like, this is showing you that individuals cannot really respond to something like this. When it happens, you need governments that are well-funded with plenty of tax revenue and competent technocratic people in place to craft responses, and then you just kind of have to trust them and elect competent people.
Yeah.
Especially that last part.
So how would you survive this movie, Will?
I don't know. I'm in it now, and we're working from home, trying not to leave our apartment too often, washing our hands a lot, my partner and I try to take like hot showers if we're outside for a long time or like on the subway as soon as we come in. Mm-hmm. It's funny because it's like it's whatever we're doing right now is how we would try to survive this film.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, yeah. I agree. My partner comes home and he washes his hand and his beard.
Yeah. Wash your beards, people.
Yeah. And I just sort of am staying home. So
yeah.
Doing what I can from in here inside of my very clean, disinfected bubble.
Yeah. It's not very dramatic, the responses. It's just kind of a day-to-day, just switching up your routine a little. You know, which Contagion, I think the film does such a great job of reflecting of like, there's not a lot of melodrama in it. It's just...
It's the cold, hard truth.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. We've talked a lot about, obviously, the context, which is right now, the coronavirus. But I think it's worth also noting that this film was made with H1N1 in mind. And that, obviously, Steven Soderbergh and the writer Scott C. Burns talked to a lot of medical experts and a few people at the CDC who served as advisors. But this film was also really informed by what happened at Hurricane Katrina, what happened at 9/11. I think the fact that it came out in early September 2011, which was the 10-year anniversary of the 9/11 attacks.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was in theaters in the context of us sort of remembering that and how New York all of a sudden became, you know, the site of a disaster movie.
Right.
One morning. And so I think it's not just the coronavirus now, but it's a movie that very much in its creation, in its release, in its repopularization now, is the product of a lot of disruptions to American society and is kind of, I think, a testament to the fact that these disruptions are going to happen. You know, it's almost like the irregular is regular on a long enough time scale.
Right. Woof. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's comforting, right?
It's also really interesting because I feel like they touch on that in the beginning of the film with the Alan character. Where, like, he almost hints, it was like, it's an attack. Like, who set this on us?
Yeah.
To, you know, feed into, like, the idea of, like, bioterrorism and, like, someone's out to get us instead of, you know, nature.
Yeah. And I've seen this in a lot of far right wing media. There's a narrative going around that every election year there's a different disease.
God,
so, like,
I
whether
hate
it's
that
SARS
meme.
Or H1N1, because mm-hmm. it's all about. The government is trying to exert more and more authority over our lives, and like the UN is behind it, and it's, you know, part of this whole globalist conspiracy. But yeah, there is a strong contingent of far right media that says that this is just the latest made up virus to try and suppress the conservative true American vote, because there's one every election year.
It's so stupid.
Yeah.
So that's Contagion.
Yeah. That's it. So this is the beginning of a viral arc. I think this is going to be our reality, the coronavirus reality, for a little bit. So we are going to continue to explore all of this. We are still hashing out exactly what our next movie is going to be.
No, we've got it. I've got it.
You got it? What is it?
So our next movie is Infection, which is one of my favorite movies of all time.
Cool.
It's a 2004 J-horror. It is no longer streaming, so I found a website that we can watch it on. And it is about the spread of a disease, and it's really, 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 really good. So that's our next movie, and I think we're going to have a lot of fun sort of... you know, a week from now, a little stir crazy. Neither of us have left our apartments.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm really excited about that. Something to look forward to.
Yeah. And you can find us at Jump Scare Pod on Twitter, on Instagram, on Facebook, at jumpscarepod@gmail.com. Everyone's home right now. Let us know how you're coping. What are you watching? What are you dealing with?
Yeah. Let us know. Stay healthy, wash your face, wash your hands, wash your face, wash your beard,
Don't talk to anyone. Don't breathe on anyone.
Yeah, don't touch anyone. Distance yourself socially and otherwise. And we'll see you next week.
All right, bye.
Bye.
You're listening to Mischief Media, the podcast network that takes stories and fandom seriously. Mischief Media has a whole collection of amazing podcasts like Make New Mistakes about being women in business, or Pottercast, the long-running podcast about Harry Potter, or Roll 9 3/4 by the same folks about doing a D&D campaign set at Hogwarts. All these and more, including our podcast Jump Scare about horror films. There is so much to enjoy on Mischief Media. Go to mischiefmedia.com and we'll see you there.
Y'all, we have some really exciting news to share with you. You can officially support Mischief Media and Jump Scare with our very own Patreon. That means that you can join us and support us in doing something really cool. One of the best things about our Patreon is that we've got a private Discord where you can meet fans just like you that have got big feelings about fandom. You've also got access to all of the Mischief Media hosts, including Will and I, where we get to talk about our favorite new trailers and movies that are coming out, which is something that we don't really get to do on our podcast. What does it mean to be a patron, Will?
Being a patron really helps us out. It means you're directly helping us bring you better quality sound, better edits, brand new shows, more episodes of your favorite shows. I mean, so many things that we just are dying to do and create. I mean, working here, I can tell you, new ideas come up every single day. And besides the fact that we all need time turners to get them all done, you know, we need financial support for some of these ideas. And being a patron really allows us to, you know, go hard on those ideas and really bring you the best possible content across all of our platforms.
So you get physical merch, you've got that private Discord community, and you've also got bonus recorded content from us, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
You've got Will and I talking about our favorite horror movies, our favorite tropes, our favorite things that necessarily don't really fit into our episodes. You also, at some point, will get to listen to an episode of Will and I super fucking drunk breaking our podcast studio. And it's a lot of fun, so please just join us. It's patreon.com/makingmischief.
Absolutely. Can't wait to see you there.
Cool. I think that was good.
Yeah.